United States submarine base at Key West, Florida. A dispatch that quoted President Truman's press secretary, Charles Ross, as saying that President Truman has no knowledge of any secret project by this government that would give substance to the existence of such objects. Ross also said that both the Air Force and the Navy deny that such objects exist.
Hi.
Hi.
The vibes are so interesting because, hey, what's up? My name's Noelle, and I have been curating the most devious and delicious groovy tits out Pinterest board for interior design all day. And so I'm riding on a high, and now I've got to get my mind into talking about a fucking Vietnam.
And I'm Chelsea. I'm the segue that goes from a 70s mid-century aesthetic into war crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting, though, because, like, we're kind of in the same time period.
I was just going to say, like, just briefly scanning over, like, what you've written in your research. I'm like, oh, history repeats itself.
And also, like, we are actually, you know, if we're looking for a segue, Nixon was the 70s, mama. And that's what I'm fucking talking about. So, let's stay in this mindset, but move from delicious interior design and go into war crimes, okay? Let me move my keyboard up because it's about to get fucking real. Put this little microphone in front of my fucking face. Okay. I like how we're just cutting to this, too. We have nothing to say.
No, there's nothing Jesus to say. Christ. I have plenty to say, but it would be like, I'd be serving water. And we're here for cake, so...
Okay.
Like, I'd be it's raining, Noelle, and I'm annoyed. No, I'm going to fucking talk about this.
Guess what's going to annoy you more? Vietnam, so...
Probably. Huge if true.
Actually, before we get into it, were you ever, like, taught and told about Vietnam?
Yes. My earliest education about Vietnam was my mom telling me that Jane Fonda was a war criminal, to which might still be burned into my psyche, because for some reason I just don't like that old bitch. But okay. I also think that Nixon or Reagan, one of those, was the first president that my parents had ever voted for. Hmm. But I don't think that that's too crazy, because I think it was of the time, maybe a little less radical to vote for Reagan or Nixon.
I mean, we'll talk about Nixon and why most people voted for him and why he got the vote and why it was like controversial. But like in school, were you taught about Vietnam?
No, fuck no. I was taught how the soldiers were treated when they came home. I was taught about the hippie movement and drugs and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But nobody ever went into the ramifications of why we would want to go into Vietnam.
Yeah.
The uselessness of that, or if you're an advocate for Vietnam, why it was important. All I know is that, fuck, dude, if anything came from Vietnam, it was probably understanding PTSD better. Maybe that's all I was taught. Yeah. And that's like loosey goosey.
Yeah. Same. We used chemical warfare in both World War II and Vietnam, but I was only told about it freely in history classes in the context of World War II. I knew, and I think there was like maybe one or two chapters about like the hippie movement, especially being in a California public school talking about that, but it was never seen in a positive light. I think the only like anti-Vietnam pictures were summarized as anti-war. And it was the, you know, putting the flower in the barrel of the gun type of shit.
Yeah.
It was never like tied to Vietnam specifically, unless you keep track of war timelines. It was always contextualized in a textbook as like, this is just anti-war, not anti-Vietnam. Yeah. And I think there are two very different, distinct conversations about both. So, getting into this, I also learned about Vietnam a little bit, and this is just scratching the surface. So let's take a trip back in time to understand the Vietnam War, or at least quickly summarize its controversy. And when I say quickly, we're still a few paragraphs all war is controversial, but the Vietnam War not only had high casualty rates to soldiers on both sides, but high casualty rates to civilians. The U.S. military participated in chemical warfare using things like Agent Orange and napalm, which were both used extensively to burn down forests and destroy food supply. It caused severe burns to people, leading to long-term injuries and death, and contributed to significant environmental destruction. While Agent Orange was colorless and musty in smell, it was also clear liquid, napalm was a highly flammable gel that smelled like gasoline and laundry detergent. Civilians caught in the deploying of napalm, either by aerial bombing or flamethrower, would have the gel stick to their skin, unable to be put out. They'd either die by being burned alive or live through with severe deformation. And if you want to look up the photo Napalm Girl, which shows a 9-year-old Kim Puck running naked on a road screaming after being severely burned on her back by a South Vietnamese napalm attack. Kim would go on to create the Kim Foundation International, which provided aid to child victims of war. So I just wanted to add that little piece in there because the photo is very disturbing. But she did live and went on to do amazing humanitarian work. So
one thing I've seen with Napalm Girl is it be erroneously attributed to the Nagasaki and like bombing attacks, which just goes to show how much like history will bleed into like maybe one travesty that we've done.
Yeah.
But really it was spread out over decades.
Yeah.
And I feel like everyone has seen this photo.
Yeah. I feel like I've seen this photo, but again, like and I don't know if this is just like the holes in my brain, but I feel like I've seen these photos and I've seen these images and I've heard the summarized versions of stories, but it was never under the context of Vietnam. You know?
Same. 100%. Like, same.
When I saw the photo of Napalm Girl, it was in the context of photojournalism through history. Yeah. It was never where, like, that this was taken in Vietnam during the Vietnam War because American soldiers burned this fucking girl with fucking napalm and a flamethrower. It was always like, look at photojournalism, just like that really well-known horrific photo of that girl who's trapped under the like log and her eyes are black.
In Colombia.
And, yeah. Like just
or that little thing. Girl with the vulture like sitting nearby.
Yes. And all three of these pictures I saw through the context of photojournalism, not the actual atrocity in which they came from.
The context of photojournalism in such a way that it is important to protect free speech because America is so great.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember when we saw like the all three of these pictures in my history class, everyone said like, why didn't the cameraman help her? Why didn't the cameraman shoo the vulture away? Why didn't they like, you know what I mean? And it's, it started that debate of like the controversy in itself of photojournalism.
Yeah.
Both the importance of it and then the morality of it. And like, where do you draw the line? Da, 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 da. We never talked about like where it came from though, like what they were doing in the situation to capture the photo. So it's very,
Like, very why are we burning children alive?
Yeah.
Why
exactly.
Are we not assisting?
Who was burning children alive? Like, why are the children like looking starved by the time you know it's just very interesting. So the U.S. employed search and destroy missions in Vietnam. These missions involved American troops entering villages to locate and destroy enemy forces, often resulting in civilian casualties, above all in the complete destruction and burning of villages. It was often during search and destroy missions where acts of sexual violence, rape, and torture were inflicted upon civilians by U.S. soldiers. One of the most infamous incidents that highlighted such abuses was the My Lai massacre in 1968. Again, excuse my pronunciation. I was never taught this. I had to look it up myself, and it's fucking horrific and terrible. Upon entering My Lai, the soldiers encountered unarmed civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. Despite encountering no significant resistance or armed threats, The troops under the command of Lieutenant William Cayley began to systematically kill the villagers. They shot people at close range, gathered groups together and executed them, and committed acts of sexual violence and mutilation. Approximately 500 civilians were killed in the massacre. Following the massacre, a cover-up ensued. Initial reports described the operation as a success, Jesus, against enemy combatants, downplaying or ignoring the civilian casualties. It wasn't until more than a year later that the truth began to emerge. Journalist Seymour Hersh, investigative reporting, and a letter from a soldier, Ron Ridenour, who had heard about the massacre, helped bring the incident to public attention. When the details of the massacre became public, it caused widespread outrage and further fueled anti-war sentiment in the U.S. The United States Army launched an investigation known as the Peers Commission, which confirmed the extent of the atrocity and recommended disciplinary action.
Honestly, I'm surprised that, like, something called Peers Commission found themselves investigating themselves, themselves guilty of the crime that they themselves committed.
But it should be telling that they called themselves the Peers Commission and were commissioning the investigation on themselves because, to continue to highlight the corruption of war in the military, Lieutenant William Cayley was court-martialed and found guilty of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison, but his sentence was later reduced to 20 years, and he was released on parole after serving just a few years. No other officers were held criminally responsible for the massacre, leading to continued criticism about the lack of broader accountability.
Well, and it just shows again, like, war is very brutal. Obviously, that is what war fucking is. But it's also a reminder that there's such things as ethical conduct in armed conflict.
Here we go. The ultimate, conversation. I mean, the thing about Vietnam, and I'll talk about it in a second, is that, like, you had, I think, like, the first wave, you had volunteers. And then the second wave, you had the draft. And when you mix people who want to be there so desperately and people who don't want to be there at all, I think it creates this environment. Not that there are many rules in war that people follow anymore. And I say this as an American who Americans have consistently and historically broken the quote unquote rules of war. It seems like there was a different type of sentiment, and not just because of, like, how we had our troops and how we got our troops and how we got them there, but why we were there in the first place. So
yeah, ultimately I think that the most realistic view I probably received of Vietnam came from Forrest Gump.
Yeah,
so sad.
Yeah. So back to Vietnam. The U.S. started carpet bombing campaigns. This tactic involved dropping large numbers of bombs over wide areas, causing significant destruction of landscapes, homes, and infrastructure. The U.S. employed B-52 bombers in heavy bombing campaigns such as Operation Rolling Thunder and Operation Linebacker. The U.S. also participated in defoliation and the destruction of crops, the intentful destruction of crops. Beyond Agent Orange, other chemical agents were used as part of a series of, quote, rainbow herbicides, end quote, to defoliate forests and destroy crops. This tactic was designed to deny enemy forces food and cover, but it also devastated local agriculture, leading to food shortages and long-term environmental harm. So again, civilian casualties. The U.S. military and southern Vietnamese government participated in mass relocation and forced internment, which they called, quote, strategic hamlets, relocating villagers into controlled areas to isolate them from Viet Cong influence. This caused disruption of traditions and way of life, and led to further displacement of the Vietnamese people. All of the above tactics ended up causing more harm and death to civilians, and caused extensive damage to the environment, widespread civilian displacement, trauma, starvation, poisoned water supplies, and severe lifelong health issues. The Vietnam War,
it's kind of a tangent, but not so much. So the pimple popping videos that I really like.
Yeah.
A lot of them come from this area.
Mm-hmm.
And a big consistency in a lot of the chats is like, why are these, like, cystic skin issues so common here, and why do they have to be treated so heavily? And it just it exceeds beyond mere acne. And a lot of people are like, this is just more fallout from the Vietnam War, where children of the parents, of the grandparents have these ramifications where, and there's no real research going into it. So a lot of it is just speculation, but it's like, look at what they are still dealing with over there, because some of it is just wild. And they have a lot of clinics that come up that just help lance these physical wounds and help keep them clean. But there are so many of them, like on teenagers or on people, that they have to have like a full team go just like, and it transcends just like pimple popping videos. They're treatment centers where people have to go to get all of these like skin lesions lanced and cleaned.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, like the environmental damage was just not temporary or generational. Like it was long lasting. It's still consistent. Like areas haven't been able to grow the same. And no one's putting money into investigating the long-term and current day effects of fucking Agent Orange and crop fields in Vietnam.
We don't even want to fucking investigate like the ground zero cancer that happened at 9/11.
We won't even treat them. You think we're dealing with Vietnam? Absolutely fucking not. Mm-mm. So the Vietnam War lasted over a decade, with the U.S. becoming increasingly entangled despite considerable domestic opposition and international criticism. Sound familiar? And of course, the forced draft also caused continued domestic opposition. The reasons for the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War are largely rooted in Cold War ideology and the domino theory, which are later criticized and obviously flawed. The war ultimately did not prevent the spread of communism in Vietnam, which fell to communist forces in 1975. So all that for what? Now let's rewind 5 years. President Richard Nixon announced on April 30th, 1970, that U.S. forces had invaded Cambodia to attack North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong bases, which escalated tensions because many Americans viewed the invasion of Cambodia as a betrayal of Nixon's earlier promise to wind down the war. Nixon's entire campaign and vote into the presidency was all based upon him saying that he would end the war.
You're trying to tell me that Nixon was a liar?
I know this might come as a shock to you. I know everyone listening cannot even begin to fathom that Nixon lied, but
I can't believe a president would say one thing to win a campaign and then completely redact on everything that they said.
I know that it's really hard to believe and understand, but this is history, and some would say it repeats. This expansion of the Vietnam War reignited and brought in new people to the anti-war protest across the U.S., including and most prolifically on college campuses. And let me go ahead and play a little video for you. This is Mario Savio. The video is titled Operation of the Machine.
Not Bert Kreischer.
No, thank God, no.
That did not come through at all.
That didn't come through at all?
It's rah, 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 rah.
God damn it. Well, it's like a kind of a hard video because it's taken from like live TV footage in front of a campus, but
let me see if I can find a quote.
I'll have to send it to you.
I did find a quote. Is that there's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. If you can't find it, we will use my audio.
Okay.
If that works. Also, I will not be editing
it. You bitch, you better fucking edit it. You better edit it in. So anyway, the University of California, Berkeley. Berkeley was already a significant hub of anti-war activism. They had been involved in the free speech movement and had a long history of student activism. Harvard University, Harvard joined the nationwide protests with rallies and demonstrations taking place on campus. The broader academic community across Ivy League schools also showed solidarity with the anti-war movement, which was like a pretty big step. Columbia University was known for their major student protests in the late 1960s with walk-offs and sit-ins. The University of Michigan students took part in the nationwide strike with large rallies and teach-ins occurring on campus. The University of Wisconsin-Madison had a strong tradition of student activism. Ohio State University experienced large protests and student strikes. The University of Illinois at Urbana. These students participated in the nationwide strike and held protests on campus. And then on May 1st, 1970, Kent State University in Kent, Ohio, joined the national anti-war protest. The students at Kent State University who protested in May of 1970 were calling for a variety of things, primarily centered around opposition to the Vietnam War and the recent U.S. invasion of Cambodia. Here's a summary of what they were calling for. The primary focus of the protest was opposition to war, which had been ongoing for years, as mentioned, the escalation with Cambodia. And the protests were a call to end the conflict. In addition to a call to end the conflict or war, students demanded the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam and other parts of Southeast Asia, emphasizing a need for rapid de-escalation. Many students also used the protest to call for greater academic freedom and the right to free speech on campuses. These calls were part of a broader movement that had started in the 1960s, challenging universities' authorities' restrictions and political activism. So a lot of the starts of the college protest pre the Vietnam War came from like Black student alliances mm-hmm. and women's alliances on campuses. So that's kind of like where it started, and then it's heading into anti-war.
Got it.
Kent State student protesters, which pre-Nixon's speech, took part in sit-ins, walkouts, and in one case, attempted to enter the student admin building with a list of demands, only to be met with arrest and disciplinary hearings. These hearings would be interrupted when students attempted to take over the music building where the hearings were being held, which resulted in 60 arrests.
I mean, a little punk rock. It's just a little punk rock.
You like that?
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to note here that even before this Kent State incident, Kent State was protesting for the removal of the ROTC building to remove it off of campus in the spring of 1960. Students and footage would show the protests throughout 1969 being very organized and peaceful, but just saying, get the ROTC building off of campus.
Yeah, they always are organized and peaceful. They're advocating for anti-violence.
Yeah.
Being disruptive is not violent.
Yeah, and being disruptive as in like they're skipping class to get together in the common area to paint signs and then like march through the common areas. It's like, be for real.
Mm-hmm.
So Kent State's protest gained the attention of Jerry Rubin, who came to the campus to speak. He was the founder of the Youth International Party, or YIP.
I don't know.
What school did you go to?
Thinking of APA from Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yip Yip.
Hell yeah. I'm part of the Yip Yip Party, motherfuckers. And then
And then you just like start airbending.
Like a beached whale. I just float through the air. Yeah, that's me.
So unlike airbenders, Jerry Rubin dropped out of Berkeley. He ran for mayor of Berkeley on a platform opposing the Vietnam War and supporting Black power and the legalization of marijuana. He gained 20% of the vote, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's actually pretty big.
It's like a lot. He became a prolific anti-war organizer and activist. He helped put together the world's largest teach-ins against the war, organized rallies, demonstrations, and even attempted to stop a train transporting troops to the Oakland Army base, as well as trucks carrying napalm. So getting Jerry Rubin to show up on your campus was a pretty big deal back in the day.
Yeah, he knows how to get into good trouble, some might say.
Yeah. Students would recall the protest as low-key, organized, and peaceful. Even the day after Nixon's address, maybe 500 of the campus's 18,000 students would be seen sitting on the hill listening to history major students have like speaking sessions throughout the day talking about their feelings on the war.
Yeah.
And imagine that. It's like a hill. There's like a almost like a football field common area and then a hill around it And then above the hill are these like multiple buildings, common areas. And these kids would just be sitting on, they called it like Blanket Hill. They'd be sitting on the hill, just watching, like watching and listening history student speakers, like on a, literally a box, on a soapbox, like talking about why you should be anti-war.
It sounds like any political protest you and I have been to.
Yeah.
And it sounds like literally every campus anywhere, because every campus pretty much looks like that.
Yeah,
like it's just, you can like, imagine a spot at your school where that
it
would
is
happen.
As casual as it gets, honestly.
Yeah.
As casual, organized, and calm as a protest could be.
Yeah.
So after the lunch hour, the student speakers were like, hey, I know we're getting ready for the weekend. Kent State was a commuter school. This was a Friday. Let's continue these discussions on Monday at noon. And everyone was like, cool, thanks, bye. The Black United Students held a meeting immediately after in the same spot, urging their members to avoid demonstrations and any of the speakings on campus in fear that they would be blamed for starting any sort of unrest or trouble or whatever. So,
yeah.
On the night of May 1st, 1970, so this is the day after Nixon's address, a protest in downtown Kent led to broken store windows, graffiti that said, fuck pigs, get out of Cambodia, which is slay, and a fire started in the street, was met with police in riot gear using tear gas. And it's important to note that, like, the protests in downtown Kent, yeah, it was students, like, at bars, but it also, like, was just people hanging out and around. Have you ever heard of the correlation with, like, break-ins and ice cream? Do you know about that?
No.
That, like, it's, I wish I could remember the stat. It's, like, it's, like, an old sociology stat that there's, like, a correlation between, like, high ice cream sales and high break-in rates. And then you are supposed to like figure out what the correlation is. And the correlation, it's not that robbers love ice cream. It's that, or that they're robbing to buy ice cream. It's summer.
I just Googled it.
Yeah.
It's because the, because high ice cream sales and high break-ins tend to increase during warmer months, and weather, warm weather, means people are going to buy ice cream, and also people are going to be outside for more frequent social gatherings.
Yeah. So some would say that the same goes for the night of May 1st in the downtown Kent protest that got a little crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first nice warm day of spring, and it was like a really nice, like the sun was staying out a little longer. It was nice and warm. The bars were filled. Mm-hmm. It was a Friday, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah.
Needless to say, showing up in riot gear and using tear gas on a crowd led to increased tension between protesters and local law enforcement. And this resulted in the declaration of a state of emergency. Let me go ahead and pause here and say the National Guard was called because of things going on outside of the university, which included, as I said, non-university civilians, obviously. But let me also say that, yes, there will always be an extremist, in heavy quotes, actors in forms of peaceful protest, just as there are always counter-protesters egging on escalation, just as there is an enforced presence that immediately feels like an infringement on your rights to gather, assemble, and protest. In the land of media trainings, we would say, quote, that doesn't make it right, but it makes it understandable how things can escalate, end quote.
Yeah, like that guy who brought a bow and fucking arrow to the George Floyd protests, saying he was there to protect the police in Salt Lake City.
Yes, and then he got jumped.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
But I would also like to say, name a time where we have experienced significant change or change in legislation or improvement in human rights due to peaceful talks alone.
Yeah, France enters the chat.
Yeah, I just dare you to show any, because, you know, there's even a discussion about civil rights here that, like, it wasn't until the Black Panther Party came to power after Martin Luther King's assassination, which is the ultimate form of violence, and that we actually started to see movements forward for Black Americans. So again, it's like, show me a time in history where peaceful talks alone have actually caused change to happen. Yeah. The answer is never. So anyway, in response to the escalating unrest, Ohio Governor James Rhodes called in the National Guard on May 2nd. They came from the trucking strike to Kent. They were already in the state, so they got there pretty quickly. The National Guard's presence was intended to maintain order and prevent further violence or property damage. The arrival of the National Guard was accompanied by an increased military presence on campus, including troops, tear gas, and military vehicles. Which I would personally say feels like the opposite of maintaining order.
It's a little martial law-y.
Yeah, and you see a lot of footage because there was like a whole media team and student journalism team on Kent. So there's a lot of footage of this and it's dystopian. And I think I even mentioned that again throughout these notes that students would recount like, yeah, it was crazy to like come back to school and like see military jeeps and like soldiers with fucking bayonets marching on campus. Mm-hmm. But the students were business as usual. Like they were just like minding their own fucking business. They were just walking past them, going to class, throwing their books. Like they almost were synchronicitous.
One might say it was an overreaction.
Yes.
To call in the National Guard.
Yeah. So, all that to say, on the night of May 2nd, the ROTC building on campus was set on fire following a down with the ROTC chant. No police were in sight. The fire department showed up. So, it started with like them throwing like rocks and shit at it. And then, of course, like one person threw something flammable and here we are. The fire department shows up to put out the flames, but leaves after believing they've doused enough of it. And protesters start cutting the fire hoses. So they're like, we're out, bye.
Yeah, they're like, oh, this isn't our fucking job or problem anymore.
Yeah, they're like, oh, okay, bye. So at this point, the National Guard appears and is given the order to shoot anyone who attempts to cut fire hoses.
Which is that's crazy. Yeah, that's crazy.
That's a bit of a jump. That's a bit
Why
of a
weren't the
jump.
Cops there to just arrest people who try to cut the hoses?
Yeah. I mean, the cops eventually came back in to escort the fire department, though. Like, that's it. Like,
it's almost like they wanted it to fucking happen.
Yeah. It feels very weird that it was like the National Guard calling the shots here.
It's almost like we knew the plane was coming in September.
Mm-hmm. Some would say. So the National Guard enforced a ban on gatherings, but protests continued on campus. These protests, again, peaceful. But the presence of the National Guard, and by peaceful, like, I mean, it's literally a dude on a box speaking into a what are those called? Those are like horn thingies, like a little...
Like a megaphone?
A megaphone. And people, like a few people sitting around and listening to him, and then people like walking to and from class, maybe stopping for a few seconds.
Yeah.
Show. The presence of the National Guard and the use of violent tactics to disperse the crowds created a highly charged atmosphere on campus, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty self-explanatory and reasonable. And it wasn't highly charged as in like, fuck them. It was just like, what the fuck's going on? It was stress. It was chaos. On May 3rd, Governor Rhodes gave a speech in Kent in which he condemned the protesters, calling them the, quote, strongest, most well-trained, militant, radical group that's ever assembled in America, end quote.
No.
Yeah, girl. Yup. And he said it. You can listen to the footage because it's obviously all recorded. He said it with such gusto in his chest. This bitch meant it, dog. He was about to cry. He meant it.
You want to know, in 1970s, the number one, like most majors at Kent State were liberal arts and humanities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Followed by sciences and engineering.
Yes. Yeah. So. It fucking bananas. He emphasized the need for law and order, showcased the National Guard's complete presence on Kent State campus, and stated that throwing rocks at law enforcement or guard personnel would become a felony. He emphasized the state of emergency and an immediate enforced curfew. Girl, get off my page.
It was an accident. I was trying to fix your misspelling, and I didn't want to be rude.
For the city. And an injunction for more police to, quote, employ every weapon possible, end quote. Again, this is all recorded. This is not a misquote. That he said this exactly. That they didn't want to they didn't want this to result in shooting, but if it came to that, so be it. Of course, this naturally heightens tensions, and we can agree that the tone has been set by the local politicians and the military.
Yeah, there's no de-escalation anywhere.
No, it's they said bet and raised it 10. And despite all of this, they kept the campus open with the conduction of full military presence. Midday, students would recall it being, again, almost surreal. A lot of students were told by their parents to keep attending as the campus was, quote, now safe with the military presence. With the curfew in place, massive traffic jams slowed the process of exiting the campus, getting to where you needed to be.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, parents at this time, like, you're still taught to trust your government. I don't think that government distrust even came about until, like, Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing to keep in mind, as I said, was that Kent was a commuter school and communication was limited. They didn't have cell phones or pagers or fax machines. So you had kids on campus who had a fair understanding of what everything that had happened, but maybe not had seen the TV presentation of the governor calling them fucking degenerates. And then you had people who were staying at their parents' house over the weekend, saw nothing, and then came on to school and was like, what the fuck's going on here?
Yeah.
So, while being told one thing to their face by the guard, like, you know, they were yelling out on these megaphones, like, curfew in place, curfew in place. And some kids would be like, what's going on? What's going on? Mm-hmm. The guard was like, well, guess what? Now you've got 5 minutes to get out of here now. Now bring in more tear gas and bayonets. On May 4th, Kent State President White had just returned from vacation. Crazy, he was gone for all this.
Oh my God.
He holds a meeting, and at this time, there's like arguments back and forth of him being like, there's no injunction in place, there's no fucking martial law, the Ohio National Guard does not have the authority to take control, but the meeting like falls off the rails, and no one has like said one thing or another or set anything in stone as far as like the National Guard is concerned, and the public is like, they're still in control. This Kent State president was like, no. And they were like, too bad, we're already here. We're already here. We already set up. We already like have this base. And the guard started sending out leaflets emphasizing the ban on gatherings. And keep in mind the ban on gatherings, because a lot of people would say that after what happens, the guard came into the school not understanding the flow of natural traffic of a 18,000 student campus.
Yeah.
So the definition of a gathering to the guard would be different to the definition of a gathering to someone just walking from one half of the campus to the other.
Right.
The guard began marching around in formation across the campus. But most students coming back to campus would continue on the day like business as usual. Again, a lot of them not understanding the full scope of the situation, and most of them being told by their parents, you're safe, you're good, the military's there, you're the most safest people in America.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll remember from before, the history student speaker from Friday said that the speeches would continue on Monday at noon. Well, Monday, May 4th at noon, this is it. It's happening. Which is also a time where classes are getting out, people are walking to their dorms or to lunch. The history students were, again, returning to their rally. And this caused basically what you could describe as like a cross-pollination walkway of students caught both just moving across campus, moving to their dorms, going to get food, walking to this rally. Like, it was across like a promenade intersection.
Yeah. And if I see that, if I have no idea what's going on, and I see a bunch of people gathering at my school, I go over and I see what's going on.
Exactly.
Like, oh, it's fucking lunchtime. I don't have a class to rush to. Like, yeah. I'm curious.
Yeah. And so to the National Guard, this would look like a gathering of people. So they proceeded down towards the area, which again caused more students like Chelsea and all of us would to stop and go, hey, what the fuck's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, the National Guard troops were ordered to disperse the crowd. One student began ringing the victory bell in the plaza, which caused the rest of the students to cheer. And I'd like just want to emphasize this scene, how almost like childish and cinematic it is. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing crazy is going on. These kids, like 75% of them, are just walking through this like common area to get to the other side where they need to be. And some of them are stopping and going like, hey, is that a fucking military marching towards us in single file line with bayonets? And you're like, what the fuck's going on? But they're a football field away. And you're like, who's the threat? What are they doing? Like, I don't even. And then you have one kid ringing a bell being like, fuck you. And then everyone's like, yeah, like that's the energy.
Yeah, we saw the same thing at the Trump rally when like the SWAT team showed up and everyone was like, oh, we're going to do our makeup and their riot shields. And it was just facetious contempt, but in a nonviolent way.
Exactly, exactly. So then this caused the guardsmen to pull up in a fucking military jeep and they do circles around the victory bell, telling the students to disperse. Honestly, if I was these students and I saw like a commander in his little military jeep doing donuts around us,
I'd get so much louder.
Yeah, I'd be like, fuck you, dude.
I'm like, what are you going to fucking do? I'm ringing a bell, pussy. Yeah,
literally. Like, this is so fucking weird. So, and they agree. The students only get louder in their chanting and they start chanting, leave our campus. And then a student throws a rock at the jeep. The guard then starts to deploy tear gas. And students begin to run from the area. The majority do. And again, we see footage and photos of this because they had a very active student journalism like department. So there's like almost as close to live feed as you can get from footage from like the 1970s as possible here. But the wind makes the tear gas fucking canisters less effective in blowing the opposite way. So some students run back and grab the canisters and throw them back. Throw them back at the fucking National Guard. And obviously, again, you're catching more common people being like, what the fuck is going on? And like stopping to sit and watch. So at this point with the students, like some students, and I want to emphasize the space. Again, it's almost like a football field of space between the guard shooting the tear gas canisters at the crowd. The crowd is almost like completely dispersed and is running in all different directions. And then you have like one, two people at a time coming to take the canisters and throw them back. So because of that, more troops are deployed and then they all start putting on their gas masks and they advance to push the protesters away from the common area and up the hill. And all the footage available, you can see the students running up the hill and away from the guard. This is just to emphasize that there was no one charging towards them at every single point they were running away. And again, a pretty good distance between them. And the guard splits at the common going up both the left and right side of the hill towards these buildings.
Oh, so they're just flanking them.
Yep, exactly. You can also see students at the top of the hill flipping off the guard and a few stopping to throw rocks. But again, no resistance, no real threat. Before we get into the heavy shit, I want to pause here and talk about someone named Terry Norman, who was a student at Kent State, who can be seen in footage and photos putting on a gas mask alongside with the guard. Following the guard, and interacting with them. He was studying criminology at the university and was an FBI informant who was carrying at the time. A like handgun.
Yeah.
And we'll get back to him. As the National Guard troops retreat back down the hill, a student throws wood at the guards and is stopped and talked to. Again, you can see this in footage. Reports are that in this same spot, Terry Norman is throwing rocks at students. And as the guard continues back up the hill, they stopped, turned, and suddenly opened fire on the crowd.
Fucking Terry.
Yeah.
Who was that bastard kid? Was it Randall on Recess? That's what Randall grew up to be.
Yeah.
Little Terry Norman.
There's a photo taken seconds before the firing takes place. The troops are almost split, half continuing forward, the other half in the middle of a turn to turn around and aim at the students. In the next 13 seconds, 37 shots are fired at 12:26 p.m.
67 shots are fired.
Oh, that's what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah.
In the next 13 seconds, 67 shots are fired at 12:26 p.m. Those near the guard would state that they had heard no order or no common talk between the guard to signify something was going to happen. Students began to scream, get down, they're shooting real bullets after seeing some of their friends hit the ground bleeding. So this was another thing that even when the shooting started, people were like running and taking cover, but still weren't like too terrified because at a lot of protests, they weren't deploying real bullets. They were deploying rubber bullets. So when they saw actual bullets and actual blood, they were like, holy fucking shit. Many troops would give statements that they had heard no command to fire, but were reacting to the other troops, believing there had been a command to fire.
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
In student journalism photos, you can see General Jones and Cantonberry moving in front of the troops, grabbing them, grabbing their guns, and forcibly stopping them. After the shooting stops, students run for cover, thinking they will be fired upon again. Others help those who have been shot. The National Guard remains on top of the hill at the pagoda, not offering assistance, despite seeing a downed Joe Lewis less than 35 yards from them. Canterbury and Jones send the troops back to the burnt down ROTC area. With the troops gone, students descend on the field to help. Professor Glenn Frank runs to the commons to get an ambulance that was stationed near the ROTC area and takes it to the hall where students have been downed. Many believe that it was Terry Norman's interactions with students here that led him to shoot with his own weapon, which was then followed by the guard shooting. Initially, the guard and the FBI denied his involvement with them, but later confirmed it. After the shooting, Sylvester DeCorso, the Ohio National Guard's top general, released a public statement that Norman had admitted firing four shots in self-defense. He later backed off from that statement. However, there were several reasons why Norman is widely believed to have played a central role in the police action. Norman worked with the FBI at the height of the counterintelligence program activities. In the words of Director J. Edgar Hoover, its purpose was to, quote, expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, or otherwise neutralize anti-war organizations, as well as individual demonstrators with no group affiliation. Students Allison Krauss and Jeffrey Miller, two of the Kent State shooting victims, fits this profile. Norman was the only person on campus other than the guardsman who admitted to having a firearm at the scene. The guard contended that a single shot of unknown origin preceded the 13-second volley of gunfire. There had been a previous and never fully explained incident on Blanket Hill in which Norman drew his gun and pointed it at students who had attacked him. Norman had scuffled with some fellow students and reportedly had drawn his gun before being chased by several men to the campus police and National Guard. One of his pursuers, graduate student Harold Reed, yelled, "Stop that man, he has a gun."
Yeah, so just a problem child. A little Kyle Rittenhouse running around.
Exactly. The reason for the abrupt decision to fire is still unclear, with conflicting accounts and explanations. Some theories suggest that the guardsmen felt threatened by the crowd, particularly given that some protesters had thrown rocks. However, one thing is clear. No evidence has ever shown that students posed a lethal threat to the National Guard.
Yeah, you're a football field away and they're throwing rocks. Like, and you're in fucking National Guard fully equipped with guns and bayonets.
Yeah. So the names I'm going to say now are the students who were killed, how far away they were from the guard when they were shot, and what happened. Jeffrey Glenn Miller was 265 feet away from the guard. He was shot through the mouth, killed instantly. Students did not realize this at the time and attempted to stop the bleeding from his head injury. Allison Beth Krause was 343 feet away from the guard. The bullet hit her in the upper left arm, shattering the bones. The bullet fragments entered her chest, causing internal bleeding. Due to the lack of response and space to take students to the hospital, she was dead on arrival. So she had been fighting for her life that entire time. Mm-hmm. And then by the time she was able to, I think like two or three ambulances had been fully loaded and taken by the time she was taken. So super unfortunate. William Knox Schroeder was 382 feet away from the guard. He sustained a fatal chest wound, shot while lying down, died almost an hour later in the local hospital while undergoing surgery. He was a member of the campus ROTC battalion, but was obviously just a civilian student at the time.
And was shot laying down.
Yeah, and was shot laying down. Sandra Lee Schroeder was 390 feet away from the guard. She sustained a fatal neck wound and died a few minutes later from loss of blood. The next list are students who were wounded. Joseph Lewis Jr. was 71 feet from the guard, hit twice, once in his right abdomen and once in his lower leg. John R. Cleary was 110 feet from the guard. He sustained a upper left chest wound. Thomas Mark Grace was 225 feet from the guard, hit in his left ankle. Alan Michael Canfora was 225 feet from the guard, hit in his right wrist. Dean R. Kaler was 258 feet from the guard, sustained a back wound, fracturing his vertebrae, and he is permanently paralyzed from the waist down. Douglas Allen Retmore was 329 feet from the guard, hit in his right knee. James Dennis Russell was 375 feet from the guard, hit in his right thigh from a bullet and grazed across his right forehead by either a bullet or I think they said like some other like ricocheted piece of shrapnel. And he was wounded near the Memorial Gymnasium, away from most of the other students. So he was like an outlier, essentially.
Yeah.
Robert Fullis Stamps was 495 feet from the guard, hit in his right butt, cheek, buttocks.
Oh, they got Bobby Stamps.
Bobby Stamps. Fuck, that sucks. And then Donald Scott McKenzie was 750 feet from the guard and sustained a neck wound. Of those shot, none was closer than 71 feet to the guardsman. Of those killed, the nearest, Miller, was 265 feet away, and the average distance from the guardsman was 345 feet. The furthest victim from the guard was 750 feet away. So I ask you, Chelsea, do you think that there was a threat?
No. An American football field is about 360 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So they were all basically a fucking football field away on average. Football
field away.
Throwing rocks.
Yep. Early news reports incorrectly indicated that multiple National Guards members had been killed or severely injured. Although numerous Guards members reported being struck by stones thrown by protesters, only one, Sergeant Lawrence Schaefer, sustained injuries serious enough to need medical attention. He received a sling for a severely bruised arm and pain medication. His injury occurred about 10 to 15 minutes before the shootings.
Hmm.
Sure. And again, if we remember Professor Glenn Frank, he gets on a megaphone and pleads to the students who have started a half sit-in after the shooting. Like, they're all kind of like sitting around dazed.
Yeah.
And there's pools of blood around. At this point, some of the students are still like waiting to get medical attention. And they're just like, but no one is wanting to leave. They're wanting answers. And so the professor is like, you guys, like, please. And he says, if you've never listened to anyone in your life, I need you to listen to me right now. And he begs them on the verge of tears to disperse, saying that, quote, they will only move in and it will only be a slaughter.
Yeah, because for all we know, they could have just regrouped to come back.
Yeah. The campus was officially closed and remained so for the next 6 weeks. During the investigations that followed, it was noted that inadequate communication among the National Guard troops contributed to the confusion. No fucking shit. The lack of clear leadership and control contributed to the decision to open fire. The troops' training and readiness for handling large crowds in a civilian context was questionable at the very fucking least.
Yeah.
And the shooting was deemed by the Scranton Commission unnecessary, unwarranted, inexcusable, and unjustified. Despite this, no one was ultimately convicted for the shootings. The Ohio National Guard's explanation centered on the perceived threat posed by the crowd, no matter how heavily contested that is.
Yeah, cops use the same argument to this day.
Yeah. Criminal court cases were dismissed, and civil trials went on for years. The civil trials concluded in 1979, and victims accepted a settlement of $675,000 to be divided among the living victims and families of those killed, as well as a letter of remorse from the Ohio National Guard.
So a slap in the face. Yeah, a slap in the face and a letter to, like, rub it in.
Mm-hmm. So this event shocked the nation, intensifying the anti-war sentiment and leading to widespread protests across the United States, especially on college campuses. The Kent State shootings became a symbol of the deepening divide in American society over the Vietnam War and the broader issues of government authority and civil liberties. The incident remains a reminder of the consequences of government and military force in response to peaceful protest. And with that all being said, I hope that this audio plays through. This is audio from right after the shootings, interviewing the people of Kent.
What do you think about the shooting at Kent?
The people weren't behaving properly, and apparently they have asked for that sort of thing.
So you think the guard was justified?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry, they didn't care more.
Really?
Yes, because they were warned, and they knew what was happening, and they should have moved out. If that's what it took to break them up, well, then that's what it takes.
Right after the shooting, we were ordered off campus. We had to leave. So I got home. My mother wasn't there. My father walked in the back door, and he looks at me, and he says, they should have shot all of them. And I said to him, and I never talked back to my father, I said, don't you know then that one of them, those people would have been me? And he just walked into the other room.
The two young women and two young men killed yesterday described by those who knew them as and revolutionary. Sandy Scheuer was 20 from Youngstown, Ohio, not much interested in politics and mainly liked to cook. Jeffrey Miller was 20 from Plainview, New York. William Schrader of Moline, Ohio. Wilson Krauss, 19 from Pittsburgh. Today her father read a statement. She resented being called in from.
And that's in reference to an article going out that said Nixon puts, quote, bums label on some college radicals.
Because she disagreed with someone else's opinion. She felt that war in Cambodia was wrong. Is this dissent a crime? Is this a reason for killing her? Have we come to such a state in this country that a young girl to be shot
because she disagrees deeply with the actions of her government?
So, I wanted to also, that lady was bleep saying killed. I wish they killed more.
It's yeah.
I wanted to cover what happened at Kent State as it mirrors what is happening on campuses around the world. As students set up peaceful encampments, participate in sit-ins, walkouts at the universities they pay to attend in protest of the genocidal campaign against Palestinians. Let me take this time to recite some of the IDF/Israel's tactics deployed against the Palestinians pre-October 7th, since people like to think what happened then justifies the carpet bombings of civilians today. Israel conducts airstrikes and ground incursions across the Gaza Strip and West Bank. They enforce, also let me know if any of these sound familiar. They enforce checkpoints, barriers, and restricted moving throughout the West Bank and along the Gaza border to control the movement of Palestinians. Israel continues to expand settlements in the West Bank, which is viewed as illegal under international law. This expansion often results in the displacement of Palestinian residents. The IDF employs the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, often citing lack of permits or security reasons. These demolitions result in displacement and death. Israel maintains extensive surveillance and intelligence networks to monitor Palestinian activities. This surveillance extends to digital platforms and social media. Israel uses administrative detention to hold Palestinians without trial or formal charges, often for extended periods. This practice is criticized for lacking transparency and due process. Israel controls the flow of goods, resources, food, water, and power into Gaza and the West Bank. Israel restricts Palestinian political activities, limits permits for public gatherings, and restricts Palestinians' participation in elections. The state of Israel has been spearheading a violent eradication campaign against the Palestinians since 1948, when 200,000 Palestinians fled or were expelled from their homes, settling in the Gaza Strip as refugees in their own countries. Since then, Israel has fought 15 wars against the Gaza Strip. Which brings me to what is happening now. On October 7th, 2022, Hamas-led fighters attacked communities. I actually think it was 2023. Hamas-led fighters attacked communities along Israel's southern fence, with Gaza killing at least 1,139 people, mostly civilians, and taking about 240 others hostage. It was a horrific tragedy. What has followed since is a complete obliteration of what's left of the Palestinian people, with a death toll of 30,000 and rising, and that's only the ones reported, with more than 70% of them, of the wounded, being women and children. They are targeting civilians, hospitals, and aid workers, preventing food, water, power supplies, and medical help to be given to the Palestinian civilians. Now, no matter what your views may be on any of this, to criticize these students' right to protest is to criticize everything this nation was built upon. To respond to the right to assembly with military force is speedrunning fascism. If you are still fighting an inner battle with how you feel about this war or protest, or maybe you have the privilege to be unbothered by it, the very least you can do is get the fuck out of the way. And I am going to play an interview from a student from Oxford. And because the U.S. college campuses inspired global university protests.
Broadly, start with disclosure and divestment. As of right now, students do not have access to where their money is going when they pay tuition fees to this university. So crucially, our first demand is full disclosure of financial investments.
Crucially about Israel, right?
Well, we want to know where all of the money is going. We think that that's key for students to know where their money is going, whether it's about Israel or not. But then, with this knowledge, we would like to pursue full divestment from two things. First, from all arms manufacturing companies. Whether it's the current genocide in Gaza or other armed conflict around the world, our university should not be investing in that. This is a situation where we should be learning and contributing to education in a safe community, not to international conflict. And secondly, we request and demand that the university divest from all holdings in any entities that sponsor or are complicit in Israeli occupation, apartheid, and the current genocide in Gaza. Additionally, we have boycott demands, key of which is the demand to stop banking with Barclays, which the university currently does. Barclays has been complicit in the architecture of Israeli apartheid, and so that's a key demand from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions global movement. And our last demand is that the university commits to a Palestinian-led rebuilding of the Gazan higher education sector.
Okay. So how much link up have you had with the movement in the United States and with other student protests in the UK?
Yeah, so crucially, I mean, the US movement set off a global chain of reaction, and we're so excited to be a part of that and thankful to the US encampments for what they began. We've had a lot of support from them in terms of logistics, general comradeship, giving us tips and tricks. But really, the UK movement has also learned a lot from them in terms of how our goals are so similar. Although the US and the UK have different contexts, the UK government is similarly complicit in Israeli war crimes, and so too are our institutions of higher education. So we learned a lot from them in terms of our demands, how to engage with our governments, and how to mobilize students. In the UK, we also have really collaborated with other universities. Oxford is so proud to be launching in tandem with Cambridge. This is the first time in like social movement history that Oxford and Cambridge have launched a campaign on the same day.
So, if you have the means, I encourage you to find your local student groups and support. Here in Utah, we have the Mecha de U of U, who is gathering donations to help students who were arrested at the protest. PSL Salt Lake, who is always posting on how you can help. And if you don't have the means, share, share, share. Do not become desensitized to injustice or make it the norm.
Yeah. What a good fucking write-up, Noel.
You like that? Just a little history lesson.
I loved it. But yeah, I think it's like it shows the slippery slope of painting these protests to be more dangerous than they are.
Yeah.
Which we see time and time again, but it's giving permission for people to respond to them violently because they are being enabled by thinking that.
Yeah.
Any discourse is like a cry for civil war, and it really isn't.
Yeah. I mean, I have no better explanation than speedrunning fascism. One of the, like, again, it's cherry picking to say, like, oh, free speech and First Amendment rights. And then to be like, well, one of our rights is to protest and assemble.
Yeah. So absolutely.
To then send military onto university students who are just like, in a circle chanting, like, be so fucking for real. So, yeah, that's Kent State. I definitely will be dropping the Mecha de U of U link in our link tree because we did have some local students at the University of Utah arrested for participating in the encampment. So just for setting up a tent in a plaza. And they are helping pay off their legal fees. And also, I highly encourage you to look for one locally to you. But also in the link tree and all of our bios, we are at Go to Hell Podcast. I'm at Noelle Fain. That is at Sithlard. We have more resources to help the people of Palestine. We also have merch, which 100% of the proceeds are donated. We also have a link to our Patreon. A dollar gets you in. We have new episodes every week. We also have a link to Kelly Holloran or at Wild Wood Owl on Etsy. She makes cool shit in general, and she makes cool shit for us. We have a link to our Discord server, and I don't know why you'd need it, but also a link to Hear Us, which is anywhere podcasts are heard.
Nice.
So that's that. And I'm going to go ahead and give a hard and heartfelt hail to Gaza as of yesterday, Monday, May 6th, the Israeli occupation forces ordered Palestinians to evacuate eastern Rafah as Israel prepares to move ahead with its invasion on the last refuge that civilians have in Gaza. There are currently more than 1.4 million Palestinians seeking refuge in Rafah, including 600,000 children. So a big hail to the people of Palestine.
And I'm going to say hail free speech. I will say continue to give them hell. Kids.
Absolutely.
So let's get the fuck out of here.
Okay.
Bye.